All right, everyone, thanks so much for coming. We are the online content team at Esri. My name is Daniel Siegel, and this is Rich Nauman and Denise Karagul. And we are going to tell you about how to do spatial analysis with online raster content. So let's get started with the basics. What is online raster content? I'm not talking about NetCDFs or TIFFs sitting on a FTP server somewhere, not downloading files from a government website. I'm talking about image services. So how many of you have ever published an image service? All right, we got a couple. How many of you have used an image service? All right, great. So you know what I'm talking about then, right? We don't want to be hunting down data and downloading it. We want to be streaming raster content through the web and just using data in our analysis. It's sitting on someone else's server, but it doesn't matter, right? We're just web services. It's the future data model for GIS. Everything is just moving through the web. So here's what that looks like. Right, you can take your own data and using ArcGIS server, you can make web services out of it. And then you register your web service with a portal. So ArcGIS Online is the central portal, but you can have your own portal as well. And once you've registered your services with portal, they then become discoverable across the entire ArcGIS platform. So whether you're working in ArcGIS Online or if you're in desktop, ArcGIS Pro, ArcMap, you're developing web applications or mobile applications, no matter where you are in the ArcGIS platform, you can pull in web services from the cloud and use them in your work. So, like I said, you can make your own services using server, but we're also trying to, as Esri, we're trying to make a strategy where we provide content to you. We think content is becoming part of the ArcGIS platform itself, and we want to make these data services as closely integrated with your work as possible. So we're developing our own content. The base map's the most obvious example of that. But we also develop data services, and then we work with our partners to create more useful online raster content that you can find in Portal and use. So the Living Atlas of the World is our new product in which we try and make this content more easily discoverable. The idea is that if you search ArcGIS Online for something you're looking for, there's going to be thousands and thousands and thousands of hits, right? Every map anyone's ever made on ArcGIS Online, you're searching through all of that. So the Living Atlas is a curated subset of ArcGIS Online. It's authoritative, ready-to-use content with nice cartography, pop-ups configured. It's well-maintained and updated as need be. So this is our sort of best of the best. This is where you look. This should be your first stop when you're looking for online content to use. So where does Living Atlas come from? Well, like I said, we develop some of it. That's part of our job. We also work with our business partners to get their own data offerings shared as web services and in the Living Atlas. And then a lot of it comes from users just like you. So if you are developing your own data services, then you can contribute them to the Living Atlas. And then other users will be able to find your data and use it, do their own work. So it's a sharing economy where we all work together to do GIS. Here's how you do that. You go to livingatlas.arcgis.com/contribute, and then you can sign in here, and it will look through all of your content, everything you've made on ArcGIS Online, and it'll give you a score based on how well you filled out the metadata. So the content item, did you make a nice thumbnail? Did you say where the data is from? Did you put tags so other people can easily find and search for your data? This will just score you based on how well you filled that out. And if once you've completely filled out the content item and documented all the metadata, then you can nominate your items to the Living Atlas, and they'll show up in our queue. And we can put them in, or we can contact you in order to say, yeah, here's a couple more things we think you should do. But that's the contribution story from the user perspective. So how do you find content in the Living Atlas? Well, each app in the platform interacts with it in its own way. They're all integrating the content story into what they do. In ArcGIS Online, it's easy enough. You just hit Browse Living Atlas Layers, and you can bring the content in quite easily. If you're just on the web, you go to the Living Atlas website and browse through a gallery of everything in there. If you're in ArcGIS Pro, they have a Browse Living Atlas button that will just allow you to quickly do the same kind of searches as the Living Atlas and bring that content in. ArcGIS for desktop, I'm sorry, ArcMap is the last app that is, the next version of it will be better integrated. But we wanted to talk about to you today is using, how do you bring this content into ArcMap for analysis. So that's going to be sort of the focus of this session. The living Alice is divided into nine different themes. I need to update this slide, but so you can see base maps. Obviously, that's the original online content. Other ones you added fairly quickly were imagery, landscape is earth information, and then we have demographics coming from the business analyst product. We have transportation and urban systems, and earth observations is the live feeds coming from sensors and satellites around the world. And then we've added an oceans theme now as well. So for those of you who do maritime science, the oceans is now a theme in the Living Atlas because we've built up enough content there finally for doing science in that realm as well. So let me just show you how this all works. One of my favorite examples is GOES. This is the geostationary satellites that NOAA maintains sitting above North America to keep an eye on our weather. And so they published the imagery coming from these satellites as an image service. And then they contributed that image service to the Living Atlas. So let's open. Let's open that up in ArcGIS Online and show you what that looks like. So there you go. This is what America looks like right now from space. They update this image service every half hour with the most recent imagery coming from those satellites. And you can, if I didn't already have it open in my web map, let me sign in and show you how this works. It's pretty cool. So you have to sign in order to access the Living Atlas. It is a product that we want to sort of limit to to people with an ArcGIS Online account. But the idea is, a second to load, that this add button up here that you all know. You can still do add from the web, you can still search ArcGIS Online, you can still, with the REST URL, connect directly to what you want. But what we've added is this this browse Living Atlas layers button. So now you can do a search just within the Living Atlas. And if I search for GOES, there, it's easy to find. In just three clicks, you can add real-time imagery from a satellite in space to your map. And this is a live image service. If you save it and then, go home, maybe you forget about it for a month, you come back, it's not going to look like this anymore. Your map has the live imagery in it, and so you can email it to people, and a month later, it will be showing the live imagery still. You don't have to do the updating yourself. You have a live image service in your map, and they're updating it for you.
So I think, too, this is such a profound change to how things work in the modern era. I mean, if you've been in the business more than 5 or 10 years, you know the search, the find, hopes you can scrape some together, download it, put it into ArcMap,
And then a day later, it's out of date.
I mean, he literally just added, near real-time satellite information to a map with three clicks. I don't know. It impresses me.
It's exciting. Yeah, it is. Another great example is the GeoDAS layers. So if I browse Living Atlas and let's say I'm interested in precipitation, or let's go with snowpack. I want to know how much snow is present throughout the Earth. Look, here we go. GeoDAS snowpack, 2000 to present. I can just add this to my map, and this is coming from a NASA model. Turn that off and go somewhere with some snow. And so this, we can click anywhere, and we can see. Okay, in March of 2000, there was 100 millimeters of water stored in the snow in the place I just clicked. And here, if I put this as a satellite imagery, it looks a little nicer. So, and this is a monthly model from NASA, so I can animate it through month by month. We can see the melt off in the summer. That's right. The time slider is essentially a filter, and so we have this huge stack of data coming from them. It's multidimensional in every sense. It's multidimensional through time, multidimensional in variable. Right, we're looking at snowpack, but soil moisture, precipitation are also part of this service. And some of those are multi-depth. So like soil moisture is at 10 depths. It's this big cube, and we use these filters to look at the exact part of the cube we want. And then when you click the identify respects the filter you've set, and it's saying, okay, you set the time sliders to December of 2001, and so here's the snow during that month. But if you wanted to say, July of 2009, I want to know what the soil moisture was in Australia of June of 2003. I mean, this is all you just three clicks, you have that information in your GIS.
And when you bring this into desktop, the geoprocessing environment recognizes and uses the time slider in there as well. So if you wanted to, use some data from 3 years ago in your analysis, you could, and compare it to before and after a fire as an example we use a lot.
So the last one I want to talk about is this one is this is just the sort of the flagship product that I think everyone should know about. This is Landsat, right? Landsat is the premier source of Earth information. They've had Landsat circling the planet since 1972, calculating or gathering 30 meter resolution data for the whole planet. It's this amazing time series information where you can compare how the Earth has changed over time. Not just, I'll just show you the way this works, not just online, is that we have three Landsat layers. We have the pan-sharpened, we have the multispectral one on the bottom here. That's all seven Landsat bands, not just red, green, and blue, but there's the near-infrared, there's the ultraviolet. It's multispectral information. And then there's also the panchromatic image service. So this one is, if I turn off this pan sharpener, you can see it. It's only black and white. But in this band, they capture information with 15-meter resolution. So it's a higher resolution band. And then by combining the two, by combining the multispectral information onto this 15-meter band, we've created a third one called the pan-sharpened Landsat. So this one's actually 15-meter resolution, but in color, and it's a really useful one for if you're just trying to visually inspect the Earth and do comparisons over time, or you want to use it as a base map. I think that's a really useful one. But the multispectral, in the end, is the one that I think really matters. Right, this is the actual spectral data that Landsat is seeing of the Earth. It looks the same right now. It's only because we're choosing to render it with red is red, green is green, blue is blue, right? This is the actual kind of, it's trying to approximate what it would look like to a person. But there's no reason to do it that way. If we click on this image display button right here, we can change the renderer. So right now it's using the natural color renderer. But let's get some non-visual bands in here. Let's look at it using the infrared band instead. And you can see in this view, the vegetation just pops out immediately. You can see where there's plant life because the chlorophyll in the leaves reflects this particular band of light very strongly. And so this is a useful band for looking at agriculture or for studying how fires have affected the landscape and how the vegetative health all around the world. Another nice one is we can even do more complicated analysis. We can do math on these bands. We can calculate NDVI on the fly from this imagery. And so for those of you who don't know NDVI, the normalized vegetative index, this is just on a score from -1 to 1, how green is this particular pixel? How much, really it's giving you not just a visual look at where vegetation is, but actually a number, a number you can use in analysis for the greenness of a particular pixel. And so you can really now start to compare across time. Yes?
Oh, no, we actually want questions.
Yeah, this is great. Yeah,
this is all so new.
Well, that actually is where I'm going next. So, yeah. So the way this works is we have the whole thing in there, right? And just to back up to those of you who haven't published an image service on your own, the way it works is you put your data into a Mosaic data set. That's the file format we use for storing all these files, and then you publish an image service from a Mosaic data set. So the way it works is the Mosaic data set mosaics your files together in order to create a single look at something that's obviously layered in a lot of different ways. And so the way we do it is it puts the best imagery on top, and we actually have an attribute on each image called best, and we calculate it based on recentness and cloud cover. So it's the most recent cloud-free image, essentially. And the short answer to your question is if you want to know where it is, you just click. And we have pop-ups configured on this stuff. It'll take a minute because there's a couple hundred images it's querying right now. Because I don't have the time slider enabled. Yeah. Absolutely. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And Landsat only passes over a spot on the Earth every 16 days, and so you won't have images from the whole Earth for every day.
Mm-hmm. So you can see the image that we're looking at right now was acquired May 23rd, you know, just a few weeks ago. It has some other metadata about the where the sun was at the time the image was taken, what the cloud cover is. Now, if I zoom out, you can see that... You see that blue square is the image we're looking at, and you're right. If I were to click over here, we'd get a totally different answer in terms of where that imagery is coming from, because we're mosaicing this whole time series together into a single look. Yeah.
So you could put the time slider on, so if you want to look at a particular day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's do that. So this image is from May 23rd, but if you the reason that it took so long is because it wasn't just querying what we're looking at; it's querying the whole time stack. And if you look at this little button right here, we can actually go through there. So there's also an image from this spot taken on April 22nd. That's the second best image. And we can kind of keep scrolling through here, January, December. And eventually we're getting back into previous years. But here's a Landsat 5 image taken in 2009. And let's say we want to use that because we want to compare... we want to compare before and after some event that we're interested in. So we can just take this name, and we can go to the image service and do this filter button right here. And we can say, let's add another expression. Let's say we're interested for when name is that. And so, that's sort of the forceful way of getting the data you're interested in. Of course, time is an attribute on this stuff. So you just easily have said, I want something after this day, but before this day. If you didn't know the name of the image you were looking for, you can use time as a filter in a more simple way. And then, of course, there's always the time slider, right? So if we just enable time animation, this little time slider will appear at the bottom. And we can just sort of animate through the time stack that way, right? It looks like we don't have anything from, but yeah. So that's the time slider allows us to move through this stuff in a useful way as well.
So in the way this is built, it's a really important concept going ahead, because when he's showing changing the renders on the side, he's not changing between data sets. So we have one service, but the server applies a render that you select and then delivers the data that you're requesting. And so, like, right now, a lot of our landscape layers I work with the soils, we built 22 rasters, 50 or 30 meter rasters to the US. It's a pain. I have to copy those to the cloud. I have to move them around. The rasters are exactly the same, but they're just reporting a different variable. So the way we're building it now is one raster with a bunch of functions and a big raster attribute table that allows you to do this kind of raster function filtering on the fly. It's really fast. It works really well. But I've noticed talking to people, it confused a lot of people. Like, did you just change to another layer? No, it's the same layer, but a different function applied.
That's a great point for any of you who are in the data sharing business. The old way of doing this would have been to take the imagery to calculate the NDVI. Now you have a whole separate folder full of files, and you're sharing that. And for every variable you want, you know your storage is going up and up and up. So we just store the imagery in its native format, and we just do these calculations on the fly.
So we're super impressed because a server is literally selecting these data and doing that NDVI processing and returning it to us. Mm-hmm. And it returns it at a scale appropriate to the display in this case.
Mm-hmm. You're essentially just applying a function change.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, there's a lot of different words for this concept in our platform, unfortunately. But yes, a function chain, a raster function, a processing template, a renderer, these are on-the-fly raster processing.
And those were what you exposed in my picking the renderer
Yes, when it said renderer, those were the different raster functions we'd put on the mosaic. Exactly. And in ArcGIS Pro, you actually have the ability to not just use the pre-configured renderers the publisher put there, but in Pro, you can make a function chain on your end and put an image service into it. So that just completely blows open your... Sorry? In ArcMap, it's like here. You have the choices of what the publisher published. But ArcPro, they've added an entirely new framework for creating your own processing templates client side, and then bringing other people's image services into there. And let's just cut to that stuff. So ArcGIS Online is cool enough, but this is about how to do analysis with this stuff in desktop. So let's get down to business, and Rich will show you how to use this stuff in desktop.
So the way we're structuring this, it worked pretty well. Is that blowing your ears out? So I'm kind of the intermission guy here, and we actually, I know this is supposed to be about desktop, but I think to understand these things, online's a lot easier way to show them and talk to them. And I've actually been talking to a lot of people over the last few days and about kind of how we do our work and how we use the software, because we're like users that work within Esri. And so for the good and for the bad, we live with it too. And so this idea is now that I mean, these guys can chime in, but a lot of my work, I have both online and desktop open at the same time, and I move back and forth between them. Oh, yeah, so we're not going to do those slides, though.
None of these?
No, I'm not going to do those today. We're going to do the other demo today. But I'm going to talk about a few little details that you need to know about to use these things in desktop, and then Denise is going to set us up and just give us a dynamite demo that actually shows some of the tricks of the trade, and she's going to run a... build a model and run a process right before our eyes, and it's going to be glorious. But so just let's give you a few tips, and I kind of tried to frame this in a little bit of a story. I've been screwing off the last couple of weeks at work, procrastinating, trying to get ready for these talks and everything else. And the nice thing about working as Esri is you can play with, like, maps and online and stuff, and it kind of looks like you're working. and no one knows, but... So one thing, I moved down here from Oregon about 5 years ago, and I got a great job offer from Esri, and I really wanted to come, but I'm like, it's Southern California, I don't know. But I'm like, wait, there's tons of snakes there. I'm like, it'll be okay. I've come to learn that not everyone's super excited about all the rattlesnakes that live around us. And there's beautiful grassy hills all around Redlands and lots of hiking trails. And like April, the first warm days of April every year is loaded with rattlesnakes. It's a great, great time. And so our colleague moved here from Florida last year and started working with us in the spring. Him and his wife tried to go be healthy and go hiking, and they used the Collector app. They're going to record the trail where the trail looked like a chicken's foot or something. Because they went up one trail, they ran into a rattlesnake, they went up another trail, and they just kept hitting these snakes. And so they're really convinced that, he says it's his wife that's afraid of the snakes, but we know who really is. And so there's a bunch of species.
Function F8.
Oh, function F8, yeah, Denise, there we go.
Duplicate.
I'll try duplicate again there. Same thing.
Yeah, no,
oh, right, that one, yeah, there we go. Come on. It's a really nice map. Are we plugged in, Denise?
Are you on three? The best maps always do.
Yeah, it's just the essence of being. But so while Denise tries to fix that, so my whole story is that I basically went, there's a couple of species that people are really afraid of. There's the Mojave Green, which has neurotoxin, and people end up hearing about it, and they're like, oh my God, it's going to bite me and kill me. Or I saw a Western Diamondback that was 12 feet long in Redlands. It's like, well, no, you didn't. And civilians try and argue with me. And so I went to a website called VertNet that's maintained by kind of the museum and zoological communities, that just is a collection of historical museum records. So I went there the other day at work and downloaded all the rattlesnake records for Riverside and San Bernardino counties here in Southern California. And so Redlands kind of sits right in. There's San Bernardino. So we're right over in here, Redlands. And you can see that there's these nice hills and everything down here. But so to convince Keith and his wife that the Mojave Green rattlesnake didn't live where we are, I made this map, and you can see that the green dots are the Mojave Green. They're all north of the San Bernardino Mountains. It's totally cool. The black diamonds are Western Diamondbacks, and they're all down in the super low desert, down by the Salton Sea below sea level. And so for a lot of my historical work with nonprofits and the Forest Service, I made maps like this in desktop. If your manager wants to see the dots, where's the salamanders, where's the timber sale, where's this creek? And so online makes it very easy. I mean, I'm using the World Hydro Reference Overlay and this World Terrain Base are both part of Living Atlas. I just opened them up in here. The counties comes from the Living Atlas. I filtered it for the two and resymbolized them. And I just downloaded these data from the website, put them in an Excel spreadsheet, and dragged and dropped them right in the desktop and symbolized it. So I have this. This is a great map. You know, you could be done with this. If I was making a map for my mom or my brother, Keith, it's good. But I'm a scientist. I come from a scientific background. So I want to throw some data on here because you can see some obvious patterns when we look at these points. We'll talk about, we'll get to desktop and some snakes. But you can see these kind of gold orange points are all up high in the mountains. That's Crotalus oregonensis. So that's the western rattlesnake that I found in Oregon all the time. So they're down here in Southern California, they're up high in the mountains. You can see that the green dots are all north in the desert. So there's obviously something ecologically going on here. These species are separated out in the environment. You can see that, you can talk about it, but we want to actually know. And so if I was a scientist, I would be thinking, if I was still a scientist, I'd be thinking about principal components analysis or some sort of multivariate thing. I could look at the climates, the temperature, precipitation, elevation sorts of things and do some analysis. And I'd say, oh, look, western diamondback rattlesnakes live in hot, hot places. The western brown rattlesnakes there, they live up high where it's cool. So we can do that. So what we could do here in desktop is we can make a server connection. You guys know server connection? There was a lot of image servers out there. People know how to do that. If we use words that people don't know, throw stuff at us. Throw tomatoes. But so I'm going to go here.
Yeah. So the idea is that he's just connecting to the server where the image service is coming from, right? We can be found them in ArcGIS online. If you want to use it in desktop, this is how you do it. You connect to the server, and that way you can bring those same image services we were looking at before into desktop.
We can show them a second.
Denise will go through all that in her demo. Yeah, she'll start at step one. And
yeah, she's going to take us all the way through, but there's a trick of the trade that I'm actually getting to here.
But every service has a REST URL. And that REST URL tells you where to find the service.
So when we come over here, I don't really have it. I'll add something so I can show you how to find it. So we'll go here, browse. We'll add landscape, elevation. And we can add the slope map. Did it take access? I clicked it twice there. We'll delete that one. So we have this one. So when you go into, when you're looking at it in a map here, you can go down and it says show item details. And so we call this the content item. It's just the web page for each service or layer map. Content items are our term. And this has, it should have everything you need to know to use this particular data set. But right here, it actually has the full server URL. And you can just hit that button to copy. You only need the first part through ArcGIS to make the connection. And when we're over here in desktop, when we were looking at this guy, it actually has this little cheater under here to help you remember to put the slash ArcGIS on it. Because even I can't remember the right way. But so you can see right here, now we have this connection to this elevation server, which is one of our landscape servers. And there's a bunch of different things that we could grab in here, but we have one simple one, which is built from the NED 30-meter elevation data for the U.S. here. So we add that. We can shut that over. And so I want to know how high these snakes are. But what I've just done here is I just drug that service over from the catalog window. There's also, when we're here, this is a kind of a little bit of a trap. You can click this, open in ArcGIS or desktop. It works great, so we can do that, and it'll wait while I'm talking. But so part of this, you need to understand the architecture. Did I not get it? Oh, yeah, I got to click the file now so that opens. So we're putting these layers, these rasters into a mosaic, and we're serving them up. The rasters remain in their kind of generally native projection, or we put them into WGS 84 or some other kind of analytical appropriate projection, but when it gets published out through the raster, it's in Web Mercator, so it lines up with web maps, which we use for historical reasons. And so it's a terrible projection, especially if you're working in Alaska or Greenland or northern Russia, to use an analysis. So when we go to be hardcore and scientific here, we want to bring this data in a projection that's not going to cause errors and distortion when we go to do analysis. Yeah, so she's going to show all that. So the basic easy thing we can do here, so I'm leaving this step out now because Denise is going to show it to you, but there's a tool called the Make Image Service Layer you run, and Denise is going to show that, and that will bring the data in rather than projecting it to Web Mercator and then forcing you to reproject it on the fly to do an analysis, you know, making three changes on that. You can just bring the data from whatever projection it's in to the projection you want in desktop. And so that's the whole gist of Denise's thing. And if you learn one thing here, that's the one trick that we got to tell you is how to get the projection right. So I'm going to pretend I did that with this NED. And I'm going to go grab a tool. Do we have the search window open? And we are going to go. What happened there? Don't click it. For our search, we're going to extract by point. Thank you. Please. It's been a long week. Extract by points. Yeah. And so this is just simple. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to take this NED and I'm going to click the NED there, it's going to work. Learn not to click the mouse. Oh, come on. This works really well. There it is. Okay, so I got it there. Oh, this is the wrong, I grabbed the wrong tool, sorry.
Extract values
2 points. So one thing I do is I use a customized toolbar. You can go in through that interface and make your own toolbar and drag all these tools into it. And so that's one reason I'm kind of bad at searching for tools, because I find them once and I make a toolbar out of it. So here's our points. We got our rattlesnakes. We got our input rasters, the NED. And we're just going to have some output points. And is it okay if I leave them in there? Denise, you sure? That's your demo. Okay. Snakes. I don't want to leave any snakes laying around. I did have a nice video of a snake rattling that I was going to show, but I thought it might be too disturbing for anyone who had particular fears. But watch this. I'm going out to the server right now. Here it comes back. Oh, no. What does it say for us? See, it happens to us, too. Background server threw an exception. Well, we're not going to... Denise has a lovely demo that she's now going to show you, but the idea is that there would be a point layer would come out there. It would have elevation for every one of those points, and you could run it in. And we can do that with slope. We could do that with bioclimates. We could do that with average temperature. Any of these layers, NDVI values, we could do that at these points. And I did it like 20 times practicing for this, and it worked every time. I've never seen that error before. We'll look at it here. You want to stay and play with it. I'm going to try and run that as soon as this is over and see why it's not working. You know, here, I'm going to click it one more time.
Yeah, no, that's the real answer is do it again and it'll work. It might work the second time. So, but yeah, I think the key takeaway here is that instead of downloading the NED and keeping it in your computer and doing analysis against it, you can just do this analysis against a service. And that way, when the USGS updates the NED, you're always working against the service. You're never doing analysis against a file that might have gotten out of date. Yeah. Slower because you're moving across the web instead of locally.
It really depends on your internet connection.
Back there.
Denise is going to show that in 1 second here.
That's the key part of all of this. In this case, it's not really an issue because we're extracting by point, right? We're not crunching the whole thing. But that's a very important thing. When you're using these web services that are global, set your processing for sure.
And the metadata that we're
using, I think Everett showed that, right? If you double click on one of these, real quick, to claim the layer, where you find the slow points. Yeah, and then you go to general. It's more information. Oh, what?
Yeah,
we'll try the other one. Try the ones we publish. I don't know who's on the elevation team, but the ones we publish, we always put a URL to that content item we showed.
Yeah, we have a go-to link in all of ours.
But that content item on ArcGIS Online will tell you all of this, and when you bring them into desktop, we try and make sure that the
that the layer information has will then be matched to the content item.
It's the collection.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, there is some limitations. It's like we're trying to hit the internet servers out here out of this building, and there's 10,000 people looking at their phones right now and everything else. So Denise is now.
Thank you, guys. Okay, so let's bring all these data sets that are introduced today, and we're going to tell you a story about how to use these image services in your analysis. Can I close this?
Yeah, you can close all my stuff. I want to see that.
Okay.
We'll figure it out later. It normally only takes like 45 seconds for that to run.
Oh, it worked.
It worked. There it is. There they are. Hang on. Yeah, so I bet that was just an internet hiccup. So Here's all the fields that I had left in there from the original records. And if we go all the way to the end, and at first this will throw you off, right? They're negative elevation values. What's gone wrong here? But those... where I showed you how much salt and sea, I actually checked that the first few times I ran it. I'm like, oh no, what's wrong with our service? And then, sure enough, there's a bunch of records around the salt and sea. It is, you know, 50 feet below sea level there, so at the points where they are. So there you are. So you can see how for a scientific workflow, so if anyone ever used MarkSan or like Linkage Mapper or any of the conservation biology related things that I've used in the past, you have to build this raster stack before you can even begin working. We're taking that out of this. What Denise is going to show you next, a model builder, you could make a model and it would just spit out a package that would be ready for whatever your preferred analytic software is.
Okay.
With all the variables you want, yeah, hundreds of them.
I'm curious, before starting everything, so how many of you ever moved in your life? Almost everyone. So that explains it. So according to American Journal of Health Promotion, in the United States, 45% of the population moves at least once every 5 years. And when we are moving, we all make some choices, right, based on our preferences. So as you can understand from my accent, I'm not from here. I moved to the United States 5 years ago from Istanbul, Turkey, to pursue my dream JS career at Esri in Redlands, California. You see the orange spot? That's Redlands. It's 1 hour away from Los Angeles area, and it's surrounded by beautiful mountains. When I moved to Redlands, which was in December, the weather was amazing. It was 70 Fahrenheit, which is like 20 centigrade degrees. I mean, who would complain wearing a t-shirt in the winter months, right? I loved it there. But 6 months later, summer hit Redlands, and it was 110 Fahrenheit, which is like 45 centigrade degrees. It was incredibly hot. So after I survived my first summer in Redlands, I decided to move to those high mountain regions around Redlands to live in a cooler climate. The big question was, where should I move into those high mountains that I can experience the sunshine? Because I'm from a Mediterranean country, we all love sun, have a cool breeze, have a nice view, and not have to climb each time to get to my place, because I'm not a mountain goat. So luckily, we have tons of ready-to-use image services in the Living Atlas that we already talked about it, that I can use and analyze them to find the perfect location for myself. So for my analysis, suitability analysis, I use 3 data sets: global landform data sets, global local relief data set, and elevation data set. I use landforms to extract high mountain regions from rest of the landform classifications because that's where I wanted to move in. Then I use global local relief to extract high relief areas to have a better view. And then I use elevation data sets to calculate aspect to find areas which face south. That way I could maximize the sunshine on my patio. And then I use elevation to calculate proper slope for a settlement. So in order to use these data sets from the Living Atlas and run these analyses on your desktop without downloading any data to your local machine, we have a little workflow that we already mentioned, but today we're going to demo together. We're going to do this. So here's the workflow that we will follow. First of all, we will find these data sets from the Living Atlas, get their URL, create a JS server connection between our ArcGIS desktop and the server, and then by using that server connection, we're going to extract the data set based on our study area, in this case, Redlands. And based on our study area's projection, I'm going to use California State Plane projection instead of WebMarketer. And then we will run analysis of slope, aspect, reclassify, and weighted sum. And then we will find the most suitable locations for myself. So let's start now. First of all, let's start with landforms. So here's the Living Atlas webpage. And when you go there, just search for...
Function F8.
I'm sorry. Okay, so here's the Living Atlas webpage that we have tons of image services and all kinds of data sets, as you can see. I'm going to search for landforms. And when you find the data set that you want, just click on the thumbnail. You're going to see the description of this data set here, how we produce this data set, the methodology and everything. And at the end of the page, you'll see the layers section. And here, you're going to see the URL link. When you click on that link, this is the server connection that we need the URL. I'm going to copy this URL and go to my desktop. So you see, this is Redlands area, my study area that I'm going to use for my analysis. I'm going to close this base map. Now you saw it. And let's create the JS server connection by clicking on Add ArcGIS Server under JS Servers and use JS Services. And here is the URL link that I'm going to paste it. And then I will add my credentials. So when we expand the server connection, you see a bunch of image services underneath of it. Today we're going to use landforms and local relief under landscape server. Before starting to use them, let's go and create a server connection with elevation server as well.
You might have a connection because I made one.
You already have that.
Maybe refresh.
Perfect.
It. Yeah. Just do the refresh on the connection.
I think we deleted that.
Right,
okay,
so
let's do it again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from the Living Atlas, I'm going to look for terrain data set this time. And I'll click on the thumbnail, scroll down to the page, click on the layer URL, and I will copy and paste the first part of this URL to my server connection. And add my credentials again. So now we have a connection to elevation server and landscape server. Let's go and start to use these data sets. I'm going to do everything in Model Builder now. So I will drag and drop these data sets to my model builder, local relief, and landforms. And then I will use Make Image Server Layer tool. So two things to remember with Make Image Server Layer tool. The reason that we're doing this Make Image Server Layer tool is when you double-click on it, you can specify your extent. So I'm specifying my extent as my study area. I'll click OK. And when you right-click on this tool, you can make a variable from environments, and you can specify your output coordinates by selecting your coordinate system that you would like to work on. So now I can copy and paste this tool for the other data sets with the parameters that we already set. And I'm going to connect them. and then let's organize them. And okay. So, and finally, I will add them to the display. That way we can see them when they're done. Okay. Let's run it. So these are, as you can see, these are global data sets. But now what we did, we're extracting those global data sets to our local data set. So this is local relief.
So it's creating in-memory layers, just like when you bring data into a desktop from your hard drive. It's making an in-memory layer that you're working with there.
Correct. So now you can see we have the data set for our own study area only. And now we can go and start to run our analysis. I'm going to reclassify my local relief and my landforms to extract the areas that I want to work with. And then I will run slope and aspect tool. And finally, I will reclassify the result of these slope and aspect. And let's connect them.
And she shows good patient technique and not clicking that mouse while the computer's doing something.
Network is a little bit slow today.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is someone asked about the relative speed of looking at web services versus local data. And remember, you can always use these web services. You can just put them into the clip tool, and you can, and therefore, clip the part you want and store it locally and be working on it from there. So that's always an option. It's a trade-off between having it locally in order for better speed, but then you lose currency if, you know, if there's updates to the service, then you don't have them. So it's
also copying the data to your computer?
Sorry?
Did you say that this process is also copying
data? This is not. We have not copied any data to I mean, it probably is in the local memory, I would suspect, but it's not a file anywhere. We didn't save a file anywhere.
Yeah.
So the reprojection is happening on ArcGIS Online, like you're having a temporary location for that data?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and what's great about this Make Image Server Layer tool is it actually reprojects directly from the file projection to your final projection without going through Web Mercator or without going through the image server projection. Yeah. It's actually directly projecting the files into your final.
And so with the exception of that one tool and that one step, this all works exactly the same as any other data, as a geoprocessing input or a model builder input. You can use it. Denise has done a ton of Python programming and stuff around it.
So now what I'm doing is I'm reclassifying these landforms. So you can see it's a categorical data set, so I can change the places that I don't want here. This is high mountain, so I give value of 2. And if it's not high mountains, I'm giving value of 0. Now I'm copying the data set, the result. And then I'm going to reclassify my local relief into 2 classes. So what I'm saying is, if the local relief is between 0 to 30 meter, then it's not interested. I'm going to give value of 0. If it's more than 30 meter of relief, then I'll give value of 2. And we would like to calculate percentage of slope. and reclassify the slope as well. So I'm going to tell if it's between 0 to 5% of slope, it's okay to live in those areas. So I'll give 1. If it's between 5% to 12% of slope, then those are nice areas. I would love to live there, so I'll give value of 2. And if it's more than 12% of slope, those are pretty scary. I'm not going to live there, so I'll give 0. A slope. And finally, I will reclassify my aspect to find areas which looks faces south. So I'll give, if it's minus 1 to 112, those are not south, so I'll give 0. If it's 112 to 247, then I'll give 2. And if it's 247 to 360, those are not south again, so I'll give 0. Say south. And finally, we're going to prioritize these inputs, and I will tell that I really want to live in high mountain regions, so I'm going to weight them with 2. And let's say some. And we can add everything together. So let's...
This is the grand finale, everyone.
Here we We're go. Starting.
Click it. Go. So you can see she's used no local data from her computer. These are all services she's hitting. This model builder is just chewing right through them here, and it's going to give us a result.
It's exciting.
Yeah. We had some real excitement before we came in. No one charged up our computers, and her cord, our cord wouldn't work. That's a good wake up for the day, but here we go. Come on.
It's a nice example because everything's coming from the web, but the pattern we usually find when people are really doing work is, of course, you're going to have some of these data sets that you have better data than is coming from the web, right? You have local data you've gathered yourself, and of course you're going to use that, but the nice thing with these web services is they can fill in the gaps, right? Maybe you have 5 out of the 7 data sets you need gathered locally, and you're like, oh, yeah. You need the information about aspect, and so these web services can just kind of fill in where you don't have better stuff gathered locally.
Did you see that?
We got the result. Where did it go?
Yeah, Liz Jackie always says, what, did you see what she just did?
The model builder did.
Not me.
Add to display.
So when we did this talk yesterday at this point, someone said, that would have taken me 3 weeks to do. So it was kind of a nice... So what do you got? Let's see some results.
Let's see.
Yeah. About which aspect in particular?
Well, just how you automate this using the model
builder. I mean, it's the same. It's basically the same as any other model builder you would build, except the inputs are different.
There's if you go to learn.arcgis.com, there's a nice resource of lessons for a lot of examples like this that you can work through.
Mm-hmm. And if it's something that would be useful to build into a lesson or a tutorial too, we like to hear that. You know, it's the...
So now you can see those blue areas. Those are the areas that are the most suitable locations that I want to live in. Let's wrap up everything what we did here today. I already published these outputs to my web map. So first of all, for our suitability analysis, what we did, we determined the data sets that we need in our analysis. So in this case, we use global landforms, global local relief, and elevation data set. Then we get their URL from the Living Atlas, create a JS connection between the server and our desktop, and then by using that connection, we extract the data set based on our study area and based on our study area's projection. And then we run analysis of aspect, slope, reclassify, and weighted sum. And here are the results. So you see high mountain regions. That's what we find by using global landform data set. And here's my house. Clearly, I'm not living on the area that I want to live in. And here is the high relief areas. And you see that green areas, those are the moderately steep areas between 5 to 12%. And these areas are the green areas are the facing areas, like facing south. And when we combine everything together, you see the blue areas that you just saw on our MXD, and it's here right now. I just published it here, and you can see the most suitable locations. And now I was curious, actually, what it really looks like underneath of these suitable locations. So I brought in one of our imagery, NAPE imagery. It's 1 meter resolution. So when you really zoom in, you can actually see what's going on there. And clearly, I'm not the only one who wants to live here. Look at that. No one wants to live here or here. And finally, I brought my layer to our web scene to see what it feels like to live around mountains. So let's see. And I would like to change the base map to imagery. I'm not good at flying, but here.
There it is. So, how long did it take you to go from that layer to this 3D web scene?
Like 2 minutes, maybe less than a minute. Yeah. It's just published too, but just one click.
Don't
and
forget
then it's
this
here.
Step. You know, you do all the work to make nice data. Don't forget to take that final step and make a nice, pretty web map out of it.
Yeah,
and
so,
how did you publish it to the web?
So from your MXD, when you publish, so I just published this layer set, the blue one, as you can see, and then on your ArcGIS Online account, in organizational account, you just create a web application and web scene, and then this is the base map that I use, basically.
The 3D base map is a living atlas layer, so you publish your own data, you just mash the two together.
Yeah, and then you just select your own layer, and that's it.
And so you can kind of see the pattern. We got 1 minute left. The pattern that we work with, so the way things work around here is management or whoever comes up with all the tech sessions, and they tell us what we're going to do. And so we got this, and I was like, desktop, that's cool. I work in desktop all day long, except it's this hybrid approach that you can kind of see. We go in, we've been exploring, looking around. You can do analysis online. We go over to desktop, do a bunch of heavy lifting with the services, publish them back up, and then put, you know, the frame on the picture at the end. I think in the past, what I made were PDFs and junky-looking MXDs, and we called the project done. You know, when her model builder finished running, that's what I used to call done on a project. I don't think that cuts it anymore in the modern era. You know, you have to put these other pieces. So I think you can't do online without desktop, and I don't think desktop works anymore without online.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Can you just share the link with everyone, and everyone can see the result?
But yeah, so that's, I think, all we have for today. If you guys got questions, we'll be here for a little while, then we'll be down at the island for the next couple hours, and then we're going home.
Yes. So you mentioned you can use clips if you just want to save the instruments to your local drive. But if you don't want to clip it, you could just use drive the calculator or something like that.
Or yeah, or even in like in her process there, she at one step saved out all the rasters as a local slope, a local.
Right, like when she used the slope tool on the elevation image service, that then created a slope raster. You know, yes, you can use them in raster calculator and slope.
Yeah, yeah.
Any tool, reclassify. Yeah.
So you could write it out to disk, or if you're worried about performance, it's not too big. You could just send it to an in-memory space, and you know, there's some other tricks to trade. So you can keep it if you want, or you can, you know, pass it along.
Yeah, and back.
If I want to remember the exact steps, I'm going to first of all search for
Yep.
I'm going to grab the URL from that, create a server link to that.
Server connection, yep.
My MXD. Add that layer to my MXD.
You can and visualize it, and it'll look just fine. It'll perform well, except that you're getting that double projection change issue. So that's why we want to go as few steps as possible with the Make Image Service Layer tool.
Okay, and so then I want to create an image service layer as a separate tool
on that connection, on the
yep.
from that
yep.
connection or on that connection. I do it on the.
So the connection is an input to the tool.
Okay,
but then you want to go into the environments and set the output coordinate system. That's the key step. If you only learn one thing at this talk, it's set the output coordinates in that system and get a good projection.
Right, and set the
image. So, and that's at the image, make image service
yep.
layer.
Yep.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
So each time the data gets reprojected, you know, it gets projected into Web Mercator and then into your local projection. You lose a little fidelity each time. So the closer you can get to the actual files, it's always better to only reproject once.
And it's actually an area that's kind of under active development. One of our coworkers, Charlie Fryer, chief cartographer, does a lot of analysis and spent like a month reprojecting rasters and comparing the output histograms and stuff. It was really pouring into the cartographic science of getting these things as accurate as possible.
Can I also set the extents in there?
Yes, yeah. And that helps speed it up too, just by limiting the universe you're grabbing rather than the whole service.
Then I can do anything I want. Just that's almost like it made it local to my machine. Yes. Local to my machine.
Yes. For all intents and purposes, it looks local, it acts local, and it's available 24/7.
And I could have, but I'm back to that. It's Landsat data that I need to filter it by date.
Yeah.
How do I then filter it by date?
In the same way you set a spatial extent, you can set an extent to
time. The time slider.
Yeah, the time slider GP will respect that.
Because I just got this local thing of Landsat imagery from a bazillion days,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Onto my machine, so now I've got a pretty big stack.
Yeah.
But if I enable time, then I can filter my layer mm-hmm. on time.
Yeah,
there's a lot of places. If you double click on the layer and go to definition query, you know that time value is an attribute there, and you can
right.
apply a filter.
But that's after I made the layer from service.
Exactly.
In my MXT.
Yeah.
Oh, this is huge.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
We've been working really hard on it.
Yeah, and then the next step is now to get all the big guys, USGS, NOAA, just get them publishing
yeah.
everything as image services, right? I mean, they're starting to get the story. They get that putting a file on an FTP is. It's not the end of their story. If they want people to
yeah.
use their data, they're starting to make these web services for you so you can just do work
yeah.
off
the problem we face is there's like five of us on a good day, one or two of us at a time working on, you know, hundreds of layers. And so our real goal is to push back towards the authoritative sources. I mean, it's better if it's NASA or USGS or whoever the service is coming from rather than me and Daniel and Denise, you know, and...
It's not hard to imagine a day where just all data is being served through web services and you know, you're not hunting for files
yeah.
anymore, right? We're all just doing analysis in the cloud.
Also, that whole time slider thing is huge, right? Because I want to show my farmers their AMDVI. I need to know when it was.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, farmers.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you guys have a good source of tips and tricks that we get like a blog or something?
Yeah, I mean, we have a blog, so yeah, you can watch that, and there's a lot of good stuff coming through there. You know, we have Twitter, we have Snapchat, and we...
What's your blog?
So if you go to resources.arcgis.com, you can click on the blog, and then we don't have multiple blogs anymore. What we do is we use tags. So within the whole blog, you can click on tags like...
Living Atlas.
Yeah, Living Atlas is a tag, Water is a tag, Imagery is a tag, and so you can see which posts apply to a specific thing of interest. Yeah, and just watch what's coming through there for tips and tricks, yeah.
So, sorry, I'm still be stuck on the question of local versus online, but so as I understand the idea of having a decurrent, because it sounds like the web map that you published is not actually recalculating all the time, right? So the web map of where you're going to live is fixed.
Although that model she made, she could share that with you.
So that was the question I'm trying to understand. So the value of leaving it on the server as opposed to extracting it first is just if you want to update it, you can run the model again.
Yeah.
And have it extract again.
Exactly. Yeah. All she has to do is come back in a year and hit that play button on that model again, and it will work. It will work the same way, but it'll be running off of the new versions of the data because it's not pointing to local data. Yeah.
You guys actually not change your URLs that often. The other thing that I've noticed over the last like 5 years, like it's happened to us. We published our servers.
Oh, sure.
Our server changes, and so like does that.
They beat us for that.
Yeah, yeah. For a long time, our job was to make, you know, demos and create, you know, I just kind of throw stuff up there. Now, you know, we've been folded into what's called the content team now because Living Atlas is a product, right? These are no longer examples. The Living Atlas is considered a product just like ArcMap is, and so the content, we consider it part of the product. and we're trying to get very good about
that. So, things that are owned by the Esri account, mm-hmm. they're super strict about not turning them off and leaving users hanging. And that's a huge question now because we're building up. There's these old legacy services, and now, you know, we're 2-3 years in. We're like, okay, we see how to build this better, but we got this old one, and we don't want to burn our users. And so there's a trick to it. You'll see now, you'll see some of the layers will have some mature support right in the title. We're trying to build that up. But we've been doing a lot of brainstorming, working on how do you push out a message to users. I mean, don't just leave a dead link in 404 error.
Yeah. So is it, last minute, so is it faster to run it this way as opposed to having the first step in your model just be to extract the latest one locally?
Is it faster? It's going to depend on what kind of processing you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for a simple example like this, running it off web services is great. If you're going to be picking 100 layers and doing band math on them, then it's probably worth taking the time just to save it locally. Yeah.
Okay. But that would just be a step in your model.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, if you watch, I mean, they talk about in the plenary, we they're adding analysis in the cloud too. So even for those massive things, what's that new product? In Pro, you can actually you can do clustered analysis in the cloud too. So instead of bringing it locally, you can just say, hey, can you take all of Landsat and average it all together and give me an average NDVI over the past 40 years, and they'll actually do the distributed processing for you and just give you the results instead of having to do it locally. So yeah, we're working on not just cloud storage, but cloud computing as well.
And so I think you kind of stumbled in or maybe thought your way into it. Part of this, so in the past, like I was saying, you know, an MXD and a PDF is what we made. Now you're making a decision support tool. So instead of Denise giving me a map of where she wants to live, now she gives me a tool that says this is how I decide where I want to live. And I'd be like, Denise, you're full of it. No one wants to live south-facing. I want to be on the north-facing, so I'm not in the sun all day getting sunburned. And so I could go make a couple quick changes in her model, hit run, and it's done. You know, 30, 40 seconds, I could have that result again. You know, and then also like things like the elevation data that went into that. So that's part of our community maps program. So it's a multi-resolution data set. So you're getting the best of whatever we have locally, which ranges from, I think, 3-meter FEMA LIDAR all the way out to 1-kilometer data in the middle of the ocean bottom. And so over time, our Rajinder Nagi, our colleague, is building up those layers and people are contributing. So over time, that elevation layer is going to change. So, I mean, I doubt it would change where Denise ran that, but if you were running a hydrologic model or something and the elevation data changed, you would get a different result. You would expect a different result. So as things change, you're like, okay, here, boss, make up your mind. You hit the button. Here's your report. You know, like, oh, no, we need, you know, the green one. So you hit the button. The model runs. It calls the services. Here's your report. You know, suppose that old GIS shop run around in circles that I did for a decade.
Actually, here's another thought on that same subject. Is for us, that's all great. A lot of the time, though, I'll get a question from someone who thinks that's a bad thing, right? They'll say, wait, if I come back in a year and do this again, I'll get a different answer. Right? That's bad, right? That makes me look like I was wrong.
NEPA planning or so. It's terrible.
So that would be a great reason to save the data locally is so you can say, oh, well, even though they updated the data, I didn't do my work wrong, right? I promise that, you know, if you do it on the old data, which I saved, you can see that the answer is still the same. So that's something to look out for if you think it's going to be bad when the data gets updated, then maybe you do want to see.
All right.
Thanks, everyone. We'll hang around if you want to come up and chat.
And we'll be downstairs till 1 o'clock. Yeah, thanks a lot for coming, everyone.
Thank you.